From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest, director James Gray, has made three films about crime, romance, and life outside of Manhattan. His newest film, Two Lovers, deals with love and life outside of Manhattan. Jim, first of all, thanks for coming back to the show again.
Well, thanks for having me, Elvis.
And one thing that really does kind of run through your films is sort of romance, like in a capital R sense, in the Byronic sense, is really important to the conception, isn't it?
I suppose that what has always attracted me to movies is an authenticity of emotion, if I may say, which verges, frankly, sometimes on melodrama. I don't think there's anything wrong with melodrama. I think that there's it's sort of a bad word to some people, but I would make a distinction between something that's melodramatic and something that is melodrama. Melodrama at its best really reaches a certain sort of higher truth, a greater truth, an emotional honesty. And that, I think, is something quite beautiful. And I think that that just has its origins in me because I love 50s movies in the United States and a lot of Italian movies.
I'd also ask you, too, because there's something kind of operatic in that sense of melodrama that you're talking about that's key to the conception of these films.
One of my favorite films of all time is Luchino Visconti's Rocco and His Brothers. And I saw that at a very influential age. And I remember just being struck by how open and direct it was with its emotion and comfortable with its emotionality in a way, frankly, that many American films were not. I mean, Nicholas Ray sometimes can get there. If you know the film In a Lonely Place, a fantastic and brooding film with Humphrey Bogart. And he occasionally did that, and so did Kazan and some other filmmakers from the 50s. And it just was something that struck me very much as the domain of cinema, where cinema should live. I mean, Orson Welles once said, he said it was the most emotional medium in the world. And sometimes I don't think it quite lives up to that, but I think it can. So that's, I guess, me trying to go for something emotional.
The thing that really occurs to me, just having seen the movie last night, that sense of how love can destroy family or hold family together, which I think also is being a fairly operatic through line, runs in your films as well.
There's no question that that's true, but I believe that. See, if I look at my own family, which is completely screwed up in its own way, but also fantastic, you know, it's like every family. What's that great opening line from Anna Karenina? Happy families are all alike. Unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. To me, what's fantastic about depicting familial life in cinema is its capacity to emphasize a certain duality, that there is the capacity for destruction and the capacity for great nurturing. That's, to me, what is at the core of drama, that's that conflict. I mean, what you're searching for in cinema or in stories, really, because that's what you're trying to do as a narrative filmmaker, I think, is ultimately tell a story simply with emotion and elegance, is to search for a story that has both external and internal conflict at its heart. In other words, external conflict, you have to fight the bad guy, right? An internal conflict is when you are at war with yourself, or the character is at war with him or herself. I mean, to be or not to be, in a way, is the most perfect expatiation of that idea. And so in familial life, there is that incredible desire the need to feel loved and to be nurtured. And at the same time, I mean, God, my brother and I wanted to destroy each other. And sometimes in unconscious ways still do, even though I adore him and we get along very well. So to me, that seems dramatic.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to director James Gray about his new film, Two Lovers. You have worked three times with, I think, one of the most openly vulnerable of actors and sort of mercurial moody of actors, Joaquin Phoenix. And you really use that vulnerability here as the cornerstone of the film.
I would not have made the movie without Joaquin. I gave him the script, and if he didn't want to do it, I wasn't going to do it. It was It was a small film, and you know, it was a film that I was thinking about making something small before the strike happened. You know, there was a big writer's strike that stopped work for a long time, and I just wanted to get a small film in before then that was personal, that I cared about. And if he didn't want to do it, it wasn't something I was going to let sit there for years. I mean, movies have a certain shelf life, and I've been very guilty, in fact, of sitting on scripts for a long time and trying to wait until they get made and everything. In any event, I had been thinking about doing a movie about love, about romance, and usually that's a comedy, romantic comedy, because the state of being in love is inherently ridiculous. I mean, we do and say utterly preposterous things. And to me, the challenge was to treat the subject of love with some degree of seriousness. It doesn't mean heaviness, but some degree of seriousness. And Joaquin is the best actor around today in the English language, for my taste, who is able to radiate a sense of internal struggle. So I just saw this character, and I based it very loosely on a novella by Dostoevsky called White Nights. And I saw Joaquin.
It is very loosely.
Yeah, well, no.
He's basically just the character. And
it's the character. Else. That's correct. And his obsession with this lovely woman that lives nearby, and the sort of, I don't want to give away the ending, but there are elements that are stolen from a certain almost bipolar person struggling with himself, you know.
White Nights particularly is a kind of a very modern neurosis, a kind of modern obsession, that division that comes out of that.
It certainly is. In fact, it is more or less proof of Dostoevsky's brilliance, how completely, as you put it, modern the conception of character seems to be. A doctor could read it and basically prescribe prescriptions for the characters in his, and it would make perfect sense, right? He's writing clearly about someone who has bipolar disorder or maybe manic depression, something that there wasn't a name for in the 19th century, but it feels so present in it and aware of its and a sophisticated depiction of neurosis.
But also a kind of infantile narcissism too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A perfect way to put it, I think, if I must say. I mean, in fact, I expressed it almost exactly that way to Joaquin over and over again on the set, that what we were after was a person who was really in his 30s and like a child, almost acting, you know, almost someone who was on the verge of a temper tantrum, you know, and coddled to some degree, all of which was our attempt to make an exaggerated version of all of us when we are in love, when we do and say stupid things. I mean, because drama is not realism. Drama is sort of heightened realism. So this is, in a way, just a strategy to get at what I think I wanted the film to really be about.
He is sort of torn between these two poles and what these two women that he is involved with represent. But also, I kind of love what you do inside. I mean, interiors are very important to you, and the sense of a home life, which I find to be really more European than American.
Well, it's funny you say that, because so much of the production design in the film's apartment was stolen from my father's walls or some of his furniture or something. It comes really from a very autobiographical place. I mean, I grew up in New York in a semi-attached row house in Queens, which is exactly like the type of house you would see in the opening of All in the Family. It's how I perceived my life growing up. It was a very small house with narrow walls, and it felt very claustrophobic, and it had a certain pathos about it, too. I mean, my childhood was not an unhappy childhood, but there's something, I don't want to say tragic, because that's the wrong word, it's too heavy, but there's a pathos about Queens, because 9 miles away was Manhattan, and over the trees, out my bedroom window, I could see all these beautiful skyscrapers, and there was such a longing. I mean, I felt that there were those people 9 miles away having all the fun, and here I am living in Archie Bunkerland, and there's a fight at the pub down the block, and it just was something that informed my childhood, really, I must say. And I would take the train to go into Manhattan, and it was like going to Oz or something, you know. And it's where I saw all these movies that I loved, the revival houses, and I think that shapes the aesthetic. I must say I'm very obsessed about trying to be detailed about the locations themselves. And we didn't build any sets for this film. And in most of my films, we didn't build the set for the apartment, that we shot in an actual location, which helps, by the way, because you can't move walls and you get a sense of claustrophobia, I think.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to director James Gray about his new film, Two Lovers, which stars Joaquin Phoenix. And, well, that sense of being trapped and that apartment that he lives in – being both kind of a jail cell and a cocoon.
That's exactly what we intended. You know, you hope – it's not that you want the audience to sit there and think of these things consciously. I mean, what you hope is that it's a just below the surface of, and makes you feel a certain way. I mean, it's part of the challenge of directing, really, is to come up with an idea in your conscious mind that you hope will work on the audience unconsciously. To me, this is the biggest challenge of making films, because if you think of something in your conscious mind and the audience is too consciously aware of it, it becomes heavy-handed or silly or over the top. Or if it's too unconscious, they don't even recognize it ever and it doesn't have any impact.
Because one of the things I find fascinating about the film is that you begin it with dealing with his own psychological damage. And I find after a while we're unsure how much of this is an actual kind of affliction versus his own sort of immaturity.
It was very important to us to make a comment on that because he is, I mean, when he shot this, I think he was 32 or 33, Joaquin was, and that he was still living at home, or that he had returned home, actually, more accurately. And we didn't want it to be a case where people said, well, he's 32 and he's still living at home and he looks like Joaquin Phoenix. Well, he returns home, and he returns home clearly because he's troubled, deeply troubled. And we felt that part of that would be a certain immaturity, and that that was a perfect thing for the depiction of a person in a state of what he thought was love, desire really, but what he thought was love.
And this desire that he thought would somehow change him and move him out of that, I mean, because he really is, for whatever reason, so unable to get out of that place that he's waiting for this desire, these feelings he had for the character played by Gwyneth Paltrow to propel him out of the state that he's in.
You know, well, we had discussed that also, and what I said to Joaquin was, in a sense, all love, romantic love, is based in some kind of fetish. What I mean is, let me give you an example. My wife, who's lovely and fantastic, and I'm very happily married, I met her at a party. If I had met her at a party and she were dressed differently or perhaps wearing, you know, what I thought was too much makeup or something, or presented a different image to me, then I might never have gone to talk to her and she would never be my wife. So in essence, surfaces do matter to us and how we perceive the other person. And in a sense, everything that we feel is a projection of what we ourselves lack. I came across a poem, not to get too sententious and pretentious, by a French poet named Louis Aragon. The poem I gave to Joaquin because it meant everything to the character and to what I thought the movie was about. And it said, loosely translated from the French, it's going to lose something, but it said, "In vain your image comes to meet me, and I am the only one who finds it. On the wall of my gaze you will find only your dreamed of shadow." Meaning, of course, that what we love, we think we love, is simply a projection of what we ourselves lack within us. This was something that Joaquin and I really discussed, and I thought it was very important to almost overtly acknowledge. In fact, in some cases we do overtly acknowledge that he doesn't know Gwyneth Paltrow's character at all, that it's all based on his projection, what he thinks he knows about her, what he thinks knowing her means, that what he thinks will save him, that it's all based on projection.
We have to take a break. My guest is director James Gray. His new film is Two Lovers. Is the treatment more pretension to come after this?
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is director James Gray. His new film is Two Lovers, which stars Joaquin Phoenix, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Vanessa Shaw. And I've found from your previous films, there's an expectation of a kind of physical violence that doesn't really happen here. The violence is all that kind of violence of what Dostoevsky called that violence of depression, and all internal because of that reason.
I think death is an important aspect, or mortality is an important aspect to any work of art, if in this case I'm using that term loosely. I always feel like that's what gives the work its power, is some kind of awareness of our mortality. And that's really the basic struggle every day. I remember reading somewhere Norman Mailer said, the older we get, the more we become who we are. And really what I think it means is the older we get, the more that death is apparent to us as an eventuality, and the more our neuroses become encrusted and more evident. So I did try to include a sense of looming disaster underneath as an undercurrent in the film, but I wanted to leave physical violence aside for now. There's only so many times you can, kill somebody in a movie, or I didn't want to make the same movie again. I had already been guilty of it, and I felt that it was time to move on in a slightly different direction.
What I sort of find really enjoyable about the films is that, in a way, they're all kind of period films. I mean, that they're contemporary is almost immaterial.
Look, if you were to turn on television and watch network dramas, the production design, for example, is always attuned to 2009, 2008, whenever the show was shot. So it has a very present feel. But that's usually way ahead of the way most people live. I mean, I went to visit my father a little while ago. He lives in the same house I grew up in Queens. And he went across to the neighbor's house to check on some plumbing problem, and I went to help him. And there were these two women living in the house that I knew growing up, and they've lived there for 30, 40 years now. And, there were 8-track tapes with, Vicky Carr sitting on the front cabinet. And, the place had been untouched for 40 years. And what you realize very quickly is that actually that's the way most people live. And the conception of what is today or what is present that we have from movies is really for the reason that we are falsely promoting, I think, a more up-to-date vision of the world. And the fact also that, someone who is 30 would live with his parents. I mean, this is actually the highest rate of adults living with their parents since the Great Depression currently. But for movies, it seems kind of weird. It makes him seem almost like an addle-brained person or something.
Well, I think you're talking about, though, it comes from movies of the 30s, actually, the studio films, where the films were meant to be aspirational and to give Americans an ideal of the way they should be living, which has translated in this most clumsy way to television.
You're completely right. There was a kind of almost a move to the verismo, the realistic in the 50s on TV, when it first came in. The Honeymooners, I mean, he certainly didn't live a glamorized existence, leading through All in the Family, where Carol O'Connor's house, it certainly wasn't, aspirational, as you might put it. But TV and movies have returned to that state of heightened fiction, which is very weird. I don't know exactly why that's happened. It's not a recent occurrence. It's probably the last 20 years or so where popular culture has promoted, in essence, a lie, an aspirational lie, if you will. I don't know why that's happened.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to sociologist and director James Gray. His new film is Two Lovers. But it does predate television. It really goes back to the kind of vision of an America, an ideal America, that all those Eastern European immigrants were trying to create here, a kind of America they thought people should be living in.
That's right.
And that thing you're talking about, your own feelings about New York, I'm sure were shaped to some extent by those movies you saw about New York.
Oh, no question. I mean, both in positive and negative ways. I mean, my vision of Manhattan is sort of part Midnight Cowboy and part My Man Godfrey. It's like the weirdest. It doesn't involve anything in the middle.
Well, interestingly, I mean, if you look at We Own the Night versus Two Lovers, I mean, in We Own the Night, New York is that thing you were talking about. It was that place in Manhattan. It's a place that Joaquin wants to be. He wants to have that club there and what it represents. But here, going into New York, is even though there's you set that big scene at San Domenico right off Central Park, and it's really kind of beautiful and aspirational in that way you talk about, it sort of represents something that's kind of insidious and not as clean and pure as the life in the outer boroughs is.
I was trying to include an element of social class and social climbing in the film for Gwyneth's character, that the insidious thing you're talking about is the shame that Joaquin Phoenix feels and being so out of place, which I must say I feel as well. I mean, I always feel every time I'm at a dinner party or whatever, I feel like I'm the one that's going to do the incredibly goofy thing, and I usually do. There is a certain darkness to the depiction of Manhattan in the film. I think it's because the surroundings of the restaurant, frankly, humiliate Joaquin. And I think that that's just my way of saying that the division of social class has a certain cruelty to it.
Just something, too, that's that aspiration and what we're talking about, an aspiration to sort of break out of the middle class has been key to the way you make movies as well, at least in terms of story.
My mother was incredibly class conscious in a way that I found, even as a kid, pretty ugly. I mean, if I may be so open, I you know, like counting the neighbor's money and because we didn't have any, you know, they have more money than God, you know, this kind of thing. And I just remember even as like a 10-year-old thinking, God, Mom, please stop. Just thinking it was so grotesque. And I guess it just, it made its way into the movies because I suppose it's a demon I'm exercising. There's no other way for me to put it. I think it was from my mother.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to director James Gray about his new film, Two Lovers. There is this need for the families in these films to kind of hold on to the kind of the rootless son. And that character has been a part of each of these films that you've done. This son who kind of wanders in is in some way like a prodigal figure and is bringing a kind of almost Nicholas Ray kind of drama back to the household.
Look, growing up where I did, my parents, you know, had no money really and didn't want me to try and become a filmmaker and were quite open about what they thought the likelihood of me being a filmmaker was, which is to say zero. I mean, my mother would say, you can't do that. You can't study movies because we don't have any connections. We've got nothing, you know. And my father said, you go into computers. All the money will be into computers. I don't have resentment towards my parents. My mother is long dead, but I certainly don't have resentment towards my father now. I love him very much because he was so afraid of my failing. And that's really out of love. He wanted me to get a safe job. And I was venturing into the unknown. I went out to California. I got a scholarship to USC, and that was the end of that. I mean, I even though they meant the best for me, it's a very dangerous and powerful idea to try and eliminate your child's dreams. I saw it with my brother as well. It's a very dangerous thing to kill a child's spirit in a way, even if you have the best of intention. You know, Maximilian Schell once said something to me. He said,
I should say he was in your first film.
He was in the first, yeah. And I can't remember how it came up, but I said something, well, he had good intentions. And I guess we were talking about a work of art or something. And Max said, the world is ruined by well-meaning people, you know, people with good hopes. And he said to me very clearly that if certain people can be very well-intentioned but have the worst possible result, and I think most parents, I have two children and I love them more than anything, and I know that I'm going to screw up terribly. The only thing you can hope is that you raise your child so that the child can come back to you and say, Dad, you screwed up in this way and this way. And the child is still somehow healthy. And you can say, yes, you're right, son or daughter, I did screw up. And I've had those conversations with my father, with whom I'm very open and I love him very much. I'm very close with him. And I think that he would probably today acknowledge everything we're talking about, that in his desire to maintain a certain standard of living for his children, he didn't want me to dream big and to want to do things that were, he thought, maybe beyond what I could do.
What does he think about the films?
Well, he says he loves them, but, you know, I think he likes some more than others. He had a lot of trouble, I think, with the second film that I made, a movie called The Yards, because it was essentially all about his business dealings. It was very autobiographical, that film. I think that he has trouble with them. They're very autobiographical in many respects. It's funny because, you know, a lot of people have come up to me and said, well, you're doing these genre movies and you're stealing from other movies. And I feel like, well, that's probably true. We all steal from everything. But I must say that maybe it means my own life is hackneyed from a 70s movie, because I've stolen mostly from my dad's life and from my brother's and my own. So I think my father's uncomfortable with a lot of the things in the films. He would never say that, by the way. You know, he would say, oh, I'm very proud of you. I love them. And then leave it at that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, particularly in my first film, Little Odessa, which is very directly autobiographical, and he does not acknowledge it at all. He's blocked it out of his mind.
Is it tough for you to go back, because you shot at some point almost every one of your films in Queens? Does it get tough to go back there because of this stuff?
Well, I have a very strange relationship with Queens. You know, I want to move back to New York very badly. I mean, I've been back to New York for long stretches when I make the films. But I live most of the time now in Los Angeles. I frankly can't afford to live in Manhattan. I just simply can't. It's been invaded by the investment bankers, although maybe that'll change now with the situation, the economic situation. But I was pretty much kicked out of the city, which I'm certain many people will be glad to hear. But I do miss it more than anything. What I miss is a sense of discovery, where you'll walk down the street and you'll see, like, in a bookstore, there'll be like some book on a sculptor that you didn't ever think of for this movie, that you could steal an image from this Eric Fischel painting, which is on the wall of this museum. You know what I mean? And you'd never intended to run into that bookstore at that time. Los Angeles probably has it. It has everything you want. It's just a different way of experiencing life. You have to get in the car and drive to it in order to experience it, if that makes sense. You can't discover it by accident, which I think is key to creativity. But that's Manhattan. Queens, it's got the subway, it's got the buses, yes, but there's not that same sense of discovery that there was for me as a kid in Manhattan. And I have a very uneasy relationship with it. I mean, I go back and I've shot all my films there, as you say, quite rightly. And I'll run into people I haven't seen in 20 years, 30 years, who are now working at the, you know, at 7-Eleven or something, or the gas station. Hey, Jimmy, how you doing, man? How you doing? And I'll be like, who are you? And they'll know me, and I'll say, oh, my God, I haven't seen you in 25 years. What are you doing? Well, I'm working here now, but I'm studying. Maybe I'll do this or that. You know, and there's something very melancholy about the experience of returning when I see people like that. And other people I went to school with have done wonderfully well, so there's no telling who will get out and who won't, I guess.
Well, we're out of time. I've got to say, I'm so glad you came by to talk about the film. Thanks so much, Jim.
Thank you, Elvis.
My guest is director James Gray. His new film is Two Lovers. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Paul Ruiz at Argo Networks in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Aspirational. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.